Welcome to TWiL, the Week in Health Law, the podcast of record for the discussion of health law and policy. For scheduling reasons, we're recording this episode on March 24th, 2015. I'm Nicholas Terry, a law professor at Indiana University McKinney School of Law in Indianapolis, and my co-host is...
Frank Pasquale, a law professor at the Francis Kings Carey School of Law at the University of Maryland.
And we're delighted today to welcome Professor Mark Rothstein. Mark has a joint appointment at the University of Louisville Brandeis School of Law and in the School of Medicine. He's well known for his research on bioethics, genetics, and health privacy, and frankly has been one of the strongest voices in this space now for, not make you blush, Mark, but for a considerable period of time. So our format is simple. Our health law topics tend to be a bit more challenging. And I thought we'd start today with something that Mark really is a true expert on and is really helping us think through these issues. And that is health research and big data. And this is a complex topic because big data seems to mean lots of different things to different people. And there is research material that's going on inside sort of the health law space, but also big data companies that are sort of peering into health space from outside. So I thought Mark would be a great person to start unraveling that and trying to figure out the issues that we should be dealing with.
Well, thanks, Nick. It's always good to talk with you and Frank, and I'm looking forward to it.
What is this big data health space? Is it stuff that's inside the health space, clinical data that's being sort of pulled off electronic medical records and then sort of moved outside into big data? Or is it stuff that's happening outside of the health law space? What exactly is going on?
Well, I think one of the challenges in coming to grips with big data and health research is that we don't really know exactly the limits of big data in this area. Obviously, it involves using analyses of electronic health records, and many of them, in fact, analyzing the results of new genome sequencing. But it also means bringing together data from disparate sources, such as consumer records or internet search terms or social media, and using all of these to look for correlations between certain conditions, I would say, because they're not even environmental or exposures or genetic markers or anything, but I'll just say conditions, certain facts and outcomes. And so big data doesn't necessarily concentrate on causation, but correlation. And once we have these, at least in theory, then we will perhaps have new avenues for research and greater understanding of health problems.
And I was wondering if I could jump in and just set the stage for, this question, maybe some others, on ethical issues in big data health research, because I read with great interest your article in the Journal of Law, Medicine, and Ethics in that topic. And just for our listeners, to make it more concrete, I wanted to give them the factual predicates behind this very interesting initiative called Project Durkheim, which is one example of many that could be in this area, where essentially in Project Durkheim, the Veterans Administration is... they allow veterans, when they're coming back, to sign up to have all of their social media postings processed with machine learning and predictive analytics and measured against an extant database of the social media postings of other veterans who had committed suicide. And the idea is that under a regime of pattern recognition, the VA can be alerted to, say, a veteran who has a pattern of posting and words that are so close to that of other veterans who had committed suicide earlier that they would be identified for potential future interventions by the VA or others. And I'm wondering, I've seen this project praised to no end in several sites that talk about big data. But as somebody that works with the Council for Big Data, Ethics, and Society, I think there might be some real issues in terms of, say, the security of the data involved, the degree to which consent should be, say, a compound authorization over many future years, or maybe needs to be gained or reaffirmed at various times. And I was just wondering if you had any impressions of this project or similar projects that sort of ring alarm bells for you, Mark.
Well, Frank, I think you described it very well. When you think about the potential of something like this to do good, it's very easy to initially say, well, that's terrific. If we can prevent one suicide, it's worth setting this up. But then you need to start thinking about, well, what are the costs of this in terms of privacy and confidentiality and unintended consequences? And I think not only are we concerned about the hackers breaking through some security firewalls, but other kinds of disclosures that might be available. It might be, you know, there could be a variety of sort of unpleasant consequences from having this most sensitive of information available. And I think the idea of sort of repeated consents periodically is it's a good one, and that ought to be the least that's done.
Yeah, I do think that, you know, when we're in many of the areas where at the vanguard of data collection and data fusion, where, you know, the velocity, variety, and volume of the information collected is just unprecedented, we really do need a lot more consideration about whether we need, say, new levels of security and new levels of consent to accompany that. Because I often worry that as, say, people are using these personalized trackers, say, or setting up with the health research kit in their phone, they don't realize the extent to which, say, a future employer or, say, future decision makers might be able to just ask for that data, or even worse, if we follow Scott Peppett's reasoning in his Full Disclosure Future article, might just expect people to give that up as a matter of course. And I think that that's something that, you know, I know that can be seen as a rather futuristic concern, but I was really happy to see your article on the ethical, legal, and social implications on personalized medicine in a journal called Future Medicine. And I think that's just so great that we are now we're getting to the point where the academic fields are actively anticipating future technological developments rather than just reacting to them.
Let's slow down for just one second, because that hypothetical, Frank, that you raise, presumably there is a fairly clear legal and ethical structure that at least should be applied in that regard. One assumes the VA is working through an IRB, and there are consent issues that are being worked through under the common rule and so on. Whereas I think that as you move, Frank, into some of the other issues that you then raised with regard to collecting data, that's tending to take place outside of that regulatory domain. Is that a fair comment, Mark?
Well, I think what Frank describes is sort of conceptually not futuristic, not very complicated, and it's the kind of issue that we've been dealing with for a decade or more. So let me sort of simplify it even more. If someone were to be constructing a biobank where they want samples of biological material and health records, it's now lawful to get an informed consent document to participate in the biobank by giving your extant samples as well as giving your current health records and your future health records. And here's where I have the problem with that. Your current records you know about, but you don't know necessarily what's going to happen in the future. So in the future, 1, 2, 5 years from now, an individual could have, you know, mental health issues, substance abuse problems, sexually transmitted infections, the whole list of sensitive issues. And by the time they develop that, they've forgotten that a year or two before they'd given automatic consent to have all updated information sent to these researchers when they would never do it in the first place with that sensitive information. I have in the past recommended that future consent or consent for future health records needs to be time limited, and just what I think is a reasonable amount is, I said, every 5 years. I don't want to burden researchers by having to go back every year, but I think 5 years is reasonable to say, okay, you can have 5 years of my records in the future, and after that you need to get new consent. So what I'm saying is that Frank describes some very interesting sort of futuristic problems. We've had these problems in the past. I'm not sure we've done a very good job yet with them.
Yeah, I do think that it's what's so interesting in so many of these areas is that there's always a pushback from, say, industry representatives who say, well, where is the problem? Is there really a huge problem right now? But then by the time that there really are serious problems materializing, then all of a sudden the line often becomes, oh, wait a second, this is a common practice. Why are you trying to regulate it or stop it? So I do think that that's a very delicate line to tread. I was wondering, in terms of your sense of, I like the five-year idea, and I like the idea of renewing consents. Would you be interested in also applying that type of principle in, say, beyond the HIPAA sphere, beyond entities covered by HIPAA, to, say, the new outside of HIPAA entities that are collecting more and more health information, the sort of quantified self stuff, the Apple Research Kit, other areas? Or do you think it might be too early to try to apply that in the Internet of Things context?
Well, I do think that the concept of renewed consent is important. I'm not sure I would say 5 years across the board. I just picked that for, you know, future health records, but it would be perhaps different if you're talking about, you know, mobile-enabled research. Do we want to have a you know, time limit for that? And I think maybe we need to think about each one separately, but I certainly think the concept is absolutely essential.
So let's broaden the subject matter a little bit from those kind of hypotheticals that you raised, both of you, to what is commonly, and I suppose relatively accurately, described as crowdsourcing clinical trials. And we are seeing a lot of sort of corporate VC-funded activity in this regard. We are seeing well-known companies such as 23andMe, who are now pivoting away from direct-to-consumer kind of applications with a little nudge from the FDA, into working with pharmaceutical companies and doing quite broad clinical research. And then we're seeing these sort of emerging technologies that we've already alluded to a couple of times, such as the very recently announced Apple Research Kit. How does our regulatory framework apply to these kinds of activities, as opposed to, for example, the standard clinical trial that you've talked about, or even the sort of the slightly extended VA hypothetical that we were working through?
Well, I think it's interesting to follow some of these early applications of this approach. Perhaps the best known one is the Parkinson's disease research that's being conducted by Sage BioNetworks using the iPhone application. This has been, in fact, IRB approved, funded in part by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. So it's sort of a hybrid of traditional research regulation and funding with the new crowdsourced mobile device-enabled research. And I think it's the right approach. I'm not sure it applies to all of the possible uses of this technology. And I think we need to go sort of slowly on this. One of the things that I would add is that the whole idea of crowdsourcing and open access really reflects a kind of hacker mentality as applied to health research. So in other words, there is sort of a hacker view that health data are just data. And the more data that we can get our hands on, the greater the likelihood is that we're going to be able to do good things and find all sorts of associations. And furthermore, that you don't need to be an expert to do this, that anybody ought to have access to this information to, you know, use it in any way they think is possible. And those other things are sort of concepts that we might want to think about.
I agree with you on that, Mark. And I was just thinking when I considered, and, you know, I will often in discussions with colleagues or even in class sometimes bring up the patients like me type of environment for sharing the health data, other environments. And the worry that I have is that, you know, on the one hand, in order to protect people's privacy, a lot of people go by just handles. So you're not, I wouldn't go by Frank Pasquale, but just by a handle, say Health Prof or something like that. But on the other hand, what I worry about sometimes is it really likely that everyone's going to be able to vet and verify the contributions of the community members in these forums? And do we sometimes worry that there might be sock puppets or astroturfing or other, you know, phenomena that are very common online of say, pharmaceutical companies or even investors or others getting some sort of representatives who are participating in an undisclosed way? I mean, I'm sure the pharmaceutical companies perhaps are not going to do that directly or make or plan on doing that, but I just worry that there might be all sorts of ways in which the data that is ostensibly just a reflection of a group of concerned patients might be influenced in ways that are very hard to detect.
Well, I think that's an interesting question, and I heard that question raised to John Wilbanks from Sage Bionetworks in connection with the Parkinson's studies. And the question was, well, you don't even know who these people are. How do you know if they even have Parkinson's disease? And he said, well, the numbers that they're getting in terms of the thousands of people who have enrolled, the assumption is that statistically this would represent noise and they can somehow statistically account for it. I don't know how accurate that is or whether that will pan out when they get the data in, but it is sort of unusual. We have had for years very exquisite, you know, criteria for inclusion and exclusion, and now we're just basically putting an announcement out online and asking people to sign up.
Well, of course, it's even more complicated than that when you look at the iPhone demographic, for example. You're clearly going to get a skew in the folks who are eligible to sign up. First of all, you have to own an iPhone and so on. And again, I think the people who are doing this say that the sheer sample size will enable them to reduce that to noise, as you say. But I want to push back a little bit, Mark, because you use the phrase hacker mentality. And I think if we have any listeners in Cupertino or nearby suburbs, that probably would raise some hackles, because what they're saying is, no, we're bringing extremely advanced data processing and massive computer power to basically try and cure cancer, and heck, you haven't done that, so give us a shot. So how do you have that conversation with those folks? How do you, what do you expect of them so as to lose the hacker label, if you like?
Well, first of all, I'm not using it in a pejorative sense, because that's how many computer experts refer to themselves. And what I simply meant to convey is that these additional sources of expertise, if you will, are beyond the usual suspects, the biostatisticians, the epidemiologists, and the clinical trial experts who are normally associated with health research. And this is the idea that we need to open it up. I've been at meetings where this is referred to as the Any Smart Girl Scout rule, where you don't have to show that you've got credentials. You don't have to show that you have been approved by any credentialing body to do the research. And I think it's a very interesting question about whether we want to subject health records and health information and health research to the same sort of broader rules that we would use for, designing new apps and new games, for example.
And there's an emerging issue as well that I've seen Barbara Evans pursue, in the sense of say a First Amendment right, or people might be saying that I have a First Amendment right to my 23andMe results, or I have a First Amendment right to gather certain forms of data. And that could be a real game changer too, if the Supreme Court decides to go in a very deregulatory direction there.
Right. I think that's certainly true. And, that's, five more, shows for you guys to talk about the changing view on return of results and access to results and duty to inform and so on.
So in terms of the overall view of democratizing science by getting more and more of this information out there, I also just wanted to note a article that sounded a note of caution, which was Paul Ohm's critique of Google Flu Trends. And, the promise of Google Flu Trends in the original research on the topic was that by analyzing massive numbers of searches around the country, if you saw a certain region, Google would be able to see that a certain region had tons of questions about achy muscles and fevers and sniffles all at once. They would know, say, faster than the CDC, whether flu was happening. And an initial critique of that I was reminded of actually at an NSF sort of function a few months ago was, the real key is to turn from data into knowledge into action. It's not really clear exactly what the action is that you pursue when you find out, say, that there's a concentration of flu-related searches in an area. But secondly, what Paul Ohm does, which is a more radical critique, is that he shows, and based on other Tim Harford's critique of Google Flu Trends, that in fact, a lot of times this type of information is really problematic, because it turned out that after a few years, once people were aware of this, then people started searching about Google Flu Trends itself, and the algorithm was too dumb to really distinguish between searches about flu trends itself or searches about other people searching about the flu from the real information that would lead you to understand whether there was flu or not. It gets back to your point about sort of whether the bad data can be drowned out or somehow massaged out using statistical methods. So I do think that this is going to be a really interesting emerging area, which will be experts in statistical analysis joining with experts in policy and law to say, there's not really a tension between privacy and innovation. In fact, knowing the provenance of data, being really solid about making sure that we understand exactly where it's coming from and where it's going to, is an integral part of the scientific method.
I think that's right. And we can get easily drawn into the technology aspects of this when there are sort of low-tech ways in which this has been done for years. So, for example, the records of purchases at a retail pharmacy of cough medicine and aspirin and things of that sort has been followed for a long time and used as a predictor of whether there is an illness around. It's only sort of more exciting now to use things like Google Flu Trends or Twitter Influenza Surveillance or Health Map Ebola Tracker or all these other kinds of new techniques.
So I thought it was interesting that as they released Research Kit, Apple also amended their developer rules, which gets you in the store or not and makes this possible. And so they actually have some specific rules on now for their developers. For example, apps conducting health-related human subject research must obtain consent from the participants. It must include nature, purpose, duration of the research, procedures, risk, benefits, a point of contact for participant questions, and a withdrawal process. I wonder, should we expect these platform owners to go further and, for example, notify us whether there's an IRB at the root of one of these protocols? Or is this something that just doesn't sit well in this sort of commercial high-tech world?
Well, I think, Apple was the first player in this area, but I think we're going to have Android-based systems developed shortly and perhaps others as well. It's an interesting question, the degree to which the hardware and software vendors can attach conditions to the use of their devices for research purposes. Keep in mind that many of these research scenarios are not covered by the common rule, would not be covered by the HIPAA privacy rule, would not be covered by state regulations, and they would basically be free to do whatever they want. And it's hard for me to imagine how Apple is going to enforce any of these agreements.
That is such a great point. And I think that this is an area where, you know, when I teach copyright, just to make a comparison here, I will often tell, you know, at the end of the semester, I'll say to students, you know, the copyright statute has governed things for so long, but nowadays there's such increasing power of these big intermediaries like Google, Apple, Facebook, etc., that their terms of service, in effect, dictate the circulation and reproducibility of lots of media that, you know, traditionally may have been more governed by the statute itself. And I'm wondering, you know, is there something we're losing here by effectively devolving, say, a lot of authority to these large companies, where we know from the past that, in fact, it's very hard for them to mirror or mimic regulatory or judicial processes within them. So do you think there are models that may be more applicable or better regulatory templates that could be applied in these areas?
Well, I don't know, Frank. It's a great question because we've had such a sort of checkered history of trying to regulate research in the traditional channels, and now to go to beyond that, I'm not sure that's going to work. The whole idea behind the internet, as the two of you know better than I, is openness. It's freedom. It's the ability to innovate and do new things. And if we're going to quote burden internet-based research with the same you know, straitjacket says the research in the past, then, you know, that would be a mistake, some people would say. I'm not so sure.
So it's, I guess, 70 years of really quite strong worldwide protection of patients, of human subjects in research. And I wonder whether, particularly now as we're sort of in this sort of gap while we're waiting for the reform of the common rule and so on, Mark, is this going to be just overtaken by our regulatory system as we've known it? Is it going to be overtaken by calls to dramatically liberalize the whole clinical trial space? We've already seen the FDA approving crowdsourcing of the trial design. Clearly now with some of these other crowdsourcing models, we're seeing the actual trial going sort of massively large scale outside of the typically foreseen regulated space. Where do you think we're going to be in 5 to 10 years on this?
Well, I don't know, but I have an idea what the greatest impetus for moving beyond traditional research regulation, and that would be, imagine that one of these crowdsourced beyond the FDA regulation, beyond the common rule, were successful. The pressure would be immense to come up with some new paradigm, some new relaxation of the rules to enable on a larger scale this kind of research to go on. Now, I don't know whether that's realistic or it's in the cards, but can you imagine what would happen if there were some crowdsourced research that developed something that was promising in, let's say, Alzheimer's disease treatment or some cancer treatment? I think the pressure would be almost irresistible.
So let's nibble at one further topic as our time draws on. I at least found it kind of interesting that after some silence on the idea of increased consumer privacy rights, the White House suddenly exploded in action a week or so ago and published their Consumer Bill of Rights. And one of the issues that I started looking at as I read through that is that we seem to continue to tread on ground that one of the issues that I saw as I read that proposed legislation was we still really don't have an understanding or an appreciation of how data flows from one regulated domain to another regulated or lighter regulated domain. Back in 2012, when both the FTC and the White House were making proposals for increased consumer privacy, they really took the approach, I think, that, well, we don't have to worry about healthcare because HIPAA's there. By the time you get to the big data reports in 2014, I think at the very least the FTC had figured things out and realized that there were regulatory gaps. There was what I call regulatory disruption with regard to the protection of health information. And I think that also explains in part the FTC's taking of the LabMD case, and also their sort of continuing interest or process with regard to the Wyndham Hotel security case. But I'm not sure the message is getting out very well that this is a problem. There were hearings last week, I think it was, or early this week, on the proposed federal breach notification law, on which we may have to do a whole program, Frank, because it really is quite embarrassing. And Jessica Rich, who's the director of the Bureau of Consumer Protection, I think, at the FTC, was there and was sort of pressing in the hearing that the breach notification proposal should include health law, should include health data, excuse me, and was sort of brushed back, saying, no, we don't have to worry about that kind of thing. You have HIPAA, and also, you know, we're trying to make data flow more in health space, so we shouldn't get in there. So as I looked at the privacy bill that came out of the White House, I was quite surprised, because to me, it did seem to apply to health space much more than I was expecting. Not perfectly, but certainly more than anything that the White House had come up with in 2012, which was the framework on which it is based. And I just wondered whether either of you had a sense of whether that bigger picture that we have to start regulating data types, whoever happens to be the data custodian, is beginning to get some traction, or whether this was just a big misprint.
Well, let me just comment briefly, Nick. That's a very interesting setup. For the last 40 years, we have been struggling to try to find a privacy policy and a legal framework. We had a chance in the 1970s to enact comprehensive privacy legislation. We didn't do it. We settled on the Privacy Act, which, as you know, only applies to the federal government. And this piecemeal approach that we have to all the various sectors is really, I think, going to prove to be not up to the job, especially when we're talking about data that can move from one sector to another. Even the HIPAA privacy rule, as we all know, was never intended to be a comprehensive privacy regulation, and there are many healthcare providers who are not even subject to the privacy rule, and we at the very least need regulations to follow the data and not be based simply in the people who are generating or possibly using the data. So I don't know what's going to cause a more comprehensive approach to this, but I think we need to continue sounding the alarm.
I agree with you, Mark. I think that that's a really important way of framing things. I think the original sin of health data privacy and fair data practices in general was the limitation of a lot of these protections to covered entities. And just as we've seen in the financial sector, that's an open invitation to regulatory arbitrage. And it leads to some perverse results, such as driving research out of, say, traditional healthcare providers and into non-traditional ones, or ones that really may not have experience or even the ethical standards or rules that are prevalent in the health sector. So I think that really is a critical issue.
So on the basis that there is no way that you can follow original sin, that was this week's The Week in Health Law. A very special thank you to Mark Rothstein for joining us. Thank you, Mark.
It's my pleasure. I enjoyed it, Nick. Frank, thank you.
We post our show notes at twihl.com. That's twihl.com. You can contact me on Twitter at NICOLASTERRY. That's at Nicholas Terry. And Frank, where can you be found?
I can be found either at Frank Pasquale or at HealthPI on Twitter.
Thank you for joining us. Have a legally interesting but healthy week.